The odds of Twitter both being running and owned by Elon Musk by the time NetChoice comes to SCOTUS is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we should buy a lettuce, basically, at this point to see whether Twitter still exists or Elon still owns it while the lettuce survives. Welcome to the weekly news hit episode of Moderated Content with myself, Evelyn Duek, and Alex Stamos. I would just like to note that we are recording at 10:43 a.m. Pacific time on Monday, November 14. And as at the time of recording, Twitter.com is still up and running, but we make no assurances that that will still be the case by the time you're listening to this.
Right. Up to the moment, we'll keep on updating you through
exactly.
The podcast as to what's happening.
Which lawmaker will Elon offend in the next 30 minutes? Okay, I think we have to start with the midterms because I do think that that's a better, sort of more consequential place to start. So, Alex, you ran this war room during the midterms with the Election Integrity Partnership following what you saw online. So tell us the general play.
Yeah, just as within 2020, our team at the Stanford Internet Observatory worked with the University of Washington Center for Informed Public, and we ran the Election Integrity Partnership. We had a war room in the basement of a building here at Stanford with students eating a huge amount of simple carbs. So one of the things I learned was that I do not have the pancreas of a 21-year-old, it turns out. I felt horrible the next day without a drop of alcohol, just eating like an undergrad for a day. So it was a busy day. You know, the amount of content we saw that you could call some kind of election disinformation, I think, was actually larger than what we saw in 2020. But overall, the effects were much more muted. A couple of things we saw. One of our theses coming into 2022 was that it would be a much more spread out environment. Post January 6th, there's been kind of a fracturing of, especially on the right, of the platforms that people are hanging out on. And that turned out to be true, that there were things that people were saying that were not true on Twitter and Facebook. But for the most part, on the big platforms, you didn't see things like calls to violence. You didn't see people threatening individuals or doxing individuals. We saw a lot of that on the alternative sites, right? So the Gab's Parler, True Social, and especially Telegram. And for me, the big platform of the night was Telegram, that there are hundreds and hundreds of channels that have become these very effective echo chambers where everybody is kind of riling the other folks up, in which you saw individual poll workers being doxed. You saw calls for protest, including bring your guns, defend, your First and Second Amendment rights, and, kind of coded calls for potential violence. And while those things ended up not happening, that is definitely where you have to be paying attention now if you want to see what's going to go on is going to be on Telegram.
Great. Okay, so a bunch of follow-ups there. The first thing is you said you didn't see a lot of this stuff on the major platforms, and I'm wondering if you have a thesis as to why that is. Was it because of better content moderation? Is it because people were deplatformed the last time around? Or is it because the audience isn't there? The audience is in these other platforms now.
Yeah, I would say it's those first two things leading to the third.
Right.
Right. And that the aggressive rules that were created in 2020 and the aggressive moderation, especially after January 6th, right? Up until Election Day 2020, there was definitely more enforcement of rules against straight up lying about elections and certainly threats against individuals. That really softened between Election Day and January 6th. And then the companies really aggressively went after folks who were spreading the big lie after January 6th, 2021. That impact, especially the deplatforming of Trump, which drove a lot of people off of Twitter and Facebook, then led to that third thing you're talking about, that the audiences have changed. So I think, yes, there is more enforcement than there was pre-2020, but also people just aren't trying, right? Like, and the other big platform is Rumble, right? So we actually saw a lot less on YouTube because all of the really big live shows, the people who are live streaming about how it's being stolen continuously, who just honestly line their butts off about every little piece of evidence as part of a grand conspiracy against, their side, those people are on Rumble now. They've moved off of YouTube. And so, I think a big part of it is just the audiences have changed to those platforms where there's effectively no possibility of them being moderated in any way. Because you have to remember, for a lot of these people, it's a grift, right? Like, they are in the business of making money. And so being on platforms where they know that they are able to still sell and where their economic lifeline is not going to be cut off is really important for them. And Rumble is directly paying some of these folks, right? So we don't know what those deals look like on the back end. There's much less visibility into Rumble economics than, say, YouTube, where there's lots of people that share their YouTube earning numbers. But those numbers might be significant. And so you might have the Charlie Kirks and such making a decent amount of money for taking their shows to Rumble.
So there's been this big debate over the last few years about the effects of deplatforming, because on the one hand, if you kick someone off one of the major platforms, you really reduce their possibility of meeting a mainstream audience. But on the other hand, if you kick them into these echo chambers, there's a possibility of them really radicalizing and sort of not having the, you know, countervailing counter speech that might help at least, you know, stop the radicalization of some people. We saw a lot less of this stuff sticking. You said there was an increase in volume, but maybe less of it sticking. Does this suggest one way or the other an answer to that debate about deplatforming?
I don't think we have a general thesis on deplatforming that comes out of this, because there's so many things happening. One of the differences here, too, is you don't really have any candidates who are kind of really effectively pushing a stop the steal, it was stolen from me line. The only person left is Carrie Lake, who is running for governor of Arizona. And since election day has been neck and neck with her opponent, Katie Hobbs, the Democrat. And because it is very close, you end up with a situation where as the vote totals go up and down, it looks like Lake's going to win or not, the dial of how much election disinformation is turned up and down, right? So if Lake is losing, it's being stolen. If Lake looks like she might win, then it's totally fine, right? And so I think like it's very hard when that is the reality you're dealing with. The other difference this year is that Fox News has, you know, on election day and election night and the day after was generally pretty responsible in the way they were not in 2020. You know, we saw this, that Fox News was responsible on election day in 2020. They're the first ones to call Arizona for Biden. They called Biden the president-elect the next morning. And then when the primetime host came on, they just went nuts. And there's absolutely no standards for Tucker and Sean Hannity and such. And that is always, you always have to remember that a lot of this stuff that you see on social media is downstream of people kind of taking their cues from people like Tucker and Sean Hannity, who are setting the stage, and then all of the local AM talk show hosts. And that has been much more mixed this year of people blaming, you know, there's still some stop the steal. Things are just ask, you know, Tucker's doing a lot of just asking questions. He said a bunch of things that are not factually true on election night about who built the machines in Maricopa County, what the root cause of the issues are in Maricopa County, whether or not votes are being counted or not. The truth is those votes that aren't scanning in the precinct-based scanners get scanned later in centralized scanners. So, you know, he's saying things that aren't true, but it's, you also see the whole Rupert Murdoch empire turning against Trump. And so you don't have kind of the unified Fox News, OANN, Newsmax kind of trifecta pushing a stop the steal narrative. And so it's really hard to figure out what is going on here, because it's just such a complicated ecosystem of major media figures as well as people on social media.
Okay, so bottom line, something along the lines of, you know, maybe companies have made progress, they have better rules, they're maybe doing better enforcement, but it's hard to tell the causative sort of impact of that, given that all of these other factors are so important.
That's right. And for me, I mean, the thing that I really always want from the companies is for them to stop threats of violence against individuals, right? Like, if people are going to say this election is not being run in the right way, to me, that is a total reasonable free speech issue. Like, there are lots of issues around election administration we talk about. Where I find it less compelling to see on the big platforms is one, when people are just straight up taking facts and then lying about this is a conspiracy driven by George Soros money or Mark Zuckerberg money or whatever. And then especially the direct calls for violence and the doxing of individuals. And that's something that the rules have been effective, right? Like, the amount of who's this individual person, let's dox them on Twitter or Facebook, has been extremely small, whereas that is rampant on Telegram. Partially because of enforcement, partially because people are just moved to those platforms. I think they think it's much more secret on Telegram, that they're not going to get caught. I don't think there's a lot of good evidence for that, but that is their thesis. And so the things that are pushing the bounds of legality around potential, what could be actually seen as potential legitimate threats against individuals, that's the kind of stuff that has moved off the major platforms for sure. And so to that extent, the, you know, I wouldn't call it deplatforming, but like the aggressive enforcement on doxing and threats to individuals definitely has driven stuff off of the big platforms.
Right. And I guess that suggests something interesting about this move towards decentralization that we're maybe seeing, if we're seeing like maybe a big move towards Mastodon or those kinds of models for moderation.
Yeah.
There is some benefit in having centralized gatekeepers in certain circumstances.
It's certainly, you know, I've been running this Mastodon instance, cybervillains.com, as a test instance. And Mastodon has nowhere near the tools necessary, even if you wanted to be an aggressive moderator of a specific Mastodon instance, because that's what you use to attract people to it. The tooling is not great at all. It's quite poor. And so there's a lot of work for the Fediverse, if people want to be able to do this, especially with kind of part-time moderators and without anybody making money, there's a lot of work that's going to have to get done on just the technical side.
Well, that'll be something to watch then, depending on what happens in the next 2 years. I believe Twitter is still up and running this 6 minutes into this podcast.
Right, Twitter is still up and running.
All right, excellent. I guess the other thing to sort of talk about in the takeaway from the midterms is what this might mean for tech policy. The big thing is that there's not as much change as we expected. If the red wave had materialized, we might have seen a lot more platform bashing, a lot more concerns about conservative censorship on social media. As it is, we're roughly in the same situation where it is really hard to find bipartisan consensus to get a lot of things through. And so there might not be a lot of change.
I mean, there is a bipartisan consensus still that tech companies are bad.
Right, exactly. Right. We could expect many more hearings bashing platform executives around the head. Further evidence in support of that is Musk getting into a Twitter war with Senator Ed Markey over the last few days, where Markey tweeted something about a Washington Post story to do with verification of a spoof account in his name.
Yeah.
Musk tweeted some very mature critiques back that, you know, why does your PP have a mask? So that is the quality of public discourse and policy conversations at the moment.
Right.
And then Markey said, you know, you're spending your time picking fights online, fix your companies or Congress will, which suggests there's sort of this big public rhetoric going to continue around.
Yeah.
Platform bashing.
So this is interesting because I personally have not liked it when elected politicians in the United States have threatened regulation to get really specific content decisions, right? Like, I really don't like that. So what is your, as a First Amendment scholar,
right,
what is your immediate opinion to how Markey is acting here? Does it make you at all uncomfortable to have these politicians trying to get very individual things done? You're not talking about, like, I'm going to pass an American DSA. You're saying, I want this specific account taken down or I want this specific account left up. You know, how do you see that interacting with kind of overall First Amendment?
Yeah, I mean, so this is actually, you know, I think that people don't show enough concern about what we call jawboning by American lawmakers of platform executives. You know, you see Democratic senators sending, you know, Facebook a letter saying, here are the 12 disinformation dozen. What are you
right.
doing about these people? I do think that's, you know, really problematic. That is, you know, that's trying to do an end run around the First Amendment because the lawmakers can't censor it directly. So they're trying to get the platforms to do it by threatening them with legislation.
Right.
So there are legitimate First Amendment issues here. But I think, you know, Markey is sort of making some general, like, get your house in order. That concerns me a lot less. There
right.
is, you know, a situation where it is appropriate for Congress to be saying to platform executives, you know, you're not running this, like, critically important platform in a responsible way. So that concerns me far, far less.
Right. Yeah, I really disagreed with that letter with the top, partially because, you know, as people who do research, we'll have our lists of here are the top spreaders of a certain kind of disinformation. We're not building that then. We're doing that so people can understand what's going on. We don't make that list so then a politician can turn around and cite it in a letter and then try to suppress. Because what do you do about that is actually, I think, a complicated. Just taking down 20 accounts is probably not the right response if you're dealing with something like vaccine disinformation.
Right.
So Musk's response here, one, like, yes, one of his responses, Markey was complaining that there's impersonators who are able now to get blue check marks. The rollout, as everybody has predicted, including hundreds of people inside of Twitter, I'm sure, allowing people to pay for a check mark has turned out to be a complete disaster for Twitter on many levels.
I mean, hilarious, though, so.
A hilarious disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about, like, some of the specific economic disasters. Markey's specifically talking about how people are able to create check-marked Ed Markey accounts, and that he doesn't like that. Musk's response, perhaps it is because your real account sounds like a parody. Okay, so I know that Musk doesn't have comms people, right, or media or PR people, but I guarantee that Tesla and SpaceX have government relations people. Tesla is a company that is partially built upon American tax law, right, that, like, you know, tax credits for both cars and solar panels are a big deal. SpaceX, something like 90-some% of their revenue comes from the U.S. government. They are a massive government contractor. I'm guessing Glenn Shotwell, the person who really runs SpaceX every day, is losing her mind because you've got Musk turning himself into a political figure and insulting the people who have to actively vote for a budget where there is a line item that directly hundreds of millions, maybe eventually billions of dollars is going to go to SpaceX.
Right. I mean, I guess this is the flip side of the thing we talked about right at the very beginning when Musk acquired Twitter about, you know, his other investments provide leverage for governments. And we're not just
yes.
talking about the Chinese government, the, you know, Indian market, the Brazilian government. Hey, it turns out the U.S. government also has that leverage, which, again, you know, we should have real questions about them using that
yeah.
because of, you know, dissatisfaction with the way a platform's being run.
Right.
But it exists.
Right. I mean, a lot of people say the U.S. government has too much influence over Mark Zuckerberg. Imagine if Mark Zuckerberg, all of his money was in Lockheed stock, right? Right. Like, now they got a lot more leverage.
I will say, though, you know, just going back to the effects of the midterms to quickly close that out before we move on to the Musk saga, our weekly segment on Elon Musk. Cue the theme music. You know, Markey's tweet was, I think, largely performative in many ways. Like, get your house in order. The idea that, you know, Congress is actually going to pass some meaningful tech legislation is not so... I would not put the probability very high. But that does not mean that Musk shouldn't worry about the law. There is a lot of law that he should be very worried about. We saw the FTC perking up its ears, which we will talk about in just a second, but we also have, and I think we've talked about this before, the Supreme Court going to weigh in on a bunch of content moderation cases and other sort of legal levers that he really should be showing much more concern about than he is. I just don't think that legislation from Congress, and also we should talk about the states just really quickly to say, you know, states are going to be really interested in this area, particularly because Congress is vacating the field and showing so little action. So
as a Supreme Court watcher,
right.
if you are one of the people who believes that Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito and some other folks are more politically driven than legally driven, the fact that there is now, if not a conservative, a edgelord who owns Twitter, do you think that actually changes how SCOTUS rules?
I mean, it's such an interesting question because you're right. Like, we seem to have been seeing like a conservative carve out for social media platforms from their general position that corporations should have free speech rights, protect the money, protect, like, this all sort itself out in the marketplace. And we're seeing them sort of show a break from this like decades long position of conservative lawyers and justices because of concerns about social media platforms. So do I think that, you know, this one platform showing more of a free speech ethos will change that? I'm not convinced. I do think that there's just generally going to be this deep suspicion of the libs in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know. I don't have a strong prediction of what's going to happen in these cases. I think the politics around the First Amendment are really weird right now. And so I'm not going to put my money down either way.
And there are also kind of weird cases that don't go direct to like the Texas issues and such that haven't gone to that level yet, right? The NetChoice case and such.
Yeah. So they will come up next year sometime, early next year, probably. You know, again, we're speculating, but it seems like the court has been very, very hungry for those. And so what happens with Twitter between now and then, who knows? And right. So we'll see.
The odds of Twitter both being running and owned by Elon Musk by the time NetChoice comes to SCOTUS is...
Yeah.
Yet.
Well, we should buy a lettuce, basically, at this point to see whether Twitter still exists or Elon still owns it while the lettuce survives. Okay, so let's turn then probably to Musk. Tell us about the security developments this week.
Okay, so Twitter made no changes to their rules or enforcement before the midterms. That was clearly something a number of people internally were fighting for. Yoel Roth, I think I'm going to give the most credit for. I've said to you, I think I'm going to nominate Yoel for a Nobel Peace Prize because for at least a short period of time, he convinced Elon Musk that there is a reason why platforms like Twitter have to have some kind of content policy, that they can't just be free speech free-for-alls because they become completely unusable and the kind of thing places that people don't want to hang out at, right? So for a short period of time, Yoel was able to hold on. But then after the midterms, we saw first the resignation, the synchronized resignation of the chief information security officer, the chief privacy officer, and the chief compliance officer of the company, all at the exact same time. Apparently, coincidentally, at the same time that they were supposed to respond to the FTC and give the FTC an update on their progress under the FTC consent decree that they
found. What a coincidence.
Yes. Almost as if those are people who, you know, we haven't talked a lot about the Joe Sullivan case, but, you know, my predecessor at Facebook, Joe Sullivan, went on to be CISO of Uber and was just convicted of hiding evidence of a breach from the FTC. The facts here are really complicated. We could probably have a very long discussion, and I have some disagreements with the U.S. Attorney's Office on this, but, like, what you can't, whatever you believe about that, clearly the Department of Justice has thrown an elbow saying, we will arrest and hold liable lower-level executives for decisions that were made by the CEO, right? Like, decisions that were made by Travis at Uber are now being criminally attached to Joe. And if you're looking at that, and you're looking at what Musk is probably asking you to do, being the chief security officer at Twitter sounds like a horrible job. In fact, I said on Twitter, you'd have to be insane to take that job right now. I understand why Leia stepped up into that position after being asked to do so. But to be able to take that job right now, you'd have to convince yourself that you're not going to be asked to do something that would put you in the same kind of personal criminal level of responsibility. And I think that that would be a hard thing to make yourself confident of with the way that Musk is acting.
Yeah, right. There was reporting this week that Musk's lawyer, Alex Spiro, said, Elon puts rockets into space, he's not afraid of the FTC. Well, that's all good and well for him, but maybe the rest of the people at the company are not so bullish about just evading.
Right. Well, he said that tell me if this is correct, that if Twitter falls out of compliance, they're not going to just start arresting random people. I think the problem that I would have is that generally, as somebody who had to sign these letters, as a chief security officer, you are personally putting your signature on a number of letters that you are filing under penalty of perjury, right? That on that letter, it says, to my best belief and knowledge, the things in this letter are true. I had to do that with the New York Department of Financial Services, had to do it with the credit card industry, the PCI DSS, had to do it with the FTC. And that is like, it's kind of you sit there and you get some indigestion, because no matter how hard you worked and how much you trust your team, one human being has no ability to understand what is happening at a humongous company of thousands of people and hundreds of thousands or millions of computers. And so you're just hoping that everybody's doing their job well and that there's not a force that's pushing them to lie. But in a situation like what Musk is doing inside of Twitter, one, half those people are gone, right? Like half the people who used to, and in some cases it sounds like more than half the people who actually implemented things that were required by the FTC are gone. So saying, to the best of my knowledge, we're compliant with this becomes impossible, because like if you have built, for example, an internal security team whose job it is to look at an internal data access and all those people are fired, there's absolutely no way you can send that letter anymore. Right.
Right. So we're going to have a longer podcast dropping into this feed later in the week with Rihanna Pfeffercon of Stanford's own Stanford Internet Observatory and Whitney Merrill, a longtime privacy lawyer and including FTC attorney. So we're going to dig into the law later in the week on that. But Alex, substantively, should we be concerned that all of these privacy people and security people have left Twitter? Like, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to your podcast. Whitney and Rihanna are fantastic, and I can't wait for the three of you to talk about the legal side. From the substantive side, I am terrified about data at Twitter right now. Twitter has a long history of data breaches due to internal data access controls. I know for a fact that's something that Leia and team really focused on over this last year and has made significant progress, and a lot of those people have been fired or they've quit. And so now, without a security team watching, this is not something where you just build it and walk away. Like, security is something you have to do. It's adversarial. You have to do it every single day. It's like playing chess. You can't, write a book on chess and then say, I'm the world's greatest chess master. You have to actually play the games. And there's nobody playing the game anymore at Twitter. And, there's these high level, but my Signal and WhatsApp is full of resumes of people who are leaving. They're just not doing so high profile. And, I'm really
worried
about...
They're not Twitter DMing it to you?
Right. I'm really worried about that. And I'm worried about Twitter going down, because Musk is making some kind of plainly incorrect statements about how Twitter's back-end services work that is clearly wrong to anybody who's actually worked on this stuff. He considers himself a genius. He can be a genius in every single kind of engineering. But it turns out that, building at scale, web scale, back-end services is a difficult, interesting job for which people get paid a lot of money, because there's not a lot of people who can do it well, and those people are correcting him. He seems to just be firing people who are saying that he's wrong.
Right. So he's tweeted recently he's going to be turning off a bunch of microservices. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that would be a bad idea.
Okay.
You know that part of Ghostbusters where where the EPA guy shuts down the containment grid and lets all the ghosts out?
Yeah.
That is how I'm envisioning somebody who has better Photoshop skills, put Elon Musk's face over, the EPA guy in Ghostbusters, because that is what's going to happen. So microservices, this is just a back-end architecture of how do you build a system like Twitter, right? What is Twitter in the end? It is a system by which you could put data into it, a tweet or an image, and then that data has to be replicated at scale for millions or hundreds of millions of people to see, right? This requires multiple layers of services where when you are on your phone, you are talking to a web service that is sitting in a data center, but behind it, after you tell the web service, here's my tweet, it has to spread that out across tens of thousands of computers on the back end, so then it can be properly replicated and show up. And so if you're Elon Musk and you have 100 million people, the job of taking one tweet from Elon Musk and copying 100 million times turns out not to be trivial, right? And you have to, one of the complicated things for Twitter, and this is true for Facebook as well, is that everybody has a different view. So on a normal web page, you can build more monolithic systems because the view everybody, if you go to io.stanford.edu right now and you want to look at all of our blog posts, every single person who logs in gets the same blog post. So if we want to, if we had a billion people who wanted to read a document at our, we could just copy that into a content distribution network around the world, and it's the same copy. The challenge for Twitter is they can't just do that, because every single time somebody reloads their feed, every single Twitter feed on the planet is different, right? 100 million people are getting totally customized feeds. And so building a service that does that, one of the ways you can do is with called microservices, where you're talking to a front-end machine. That front-end machine is talking to dozens and dozens of services behind it, and each of those services talk to a dozen services behind. And so one thing he was talking about that he didn't really understand is that if you reload a Twitter timeline, it quite possibly touches 1,000 different systems inside of Twitter. That is by design. That is faster than trying to build some kind of big monolithic system. That is the exact same thing that happens at Facebook, right? Like, just putting somebody's Facebook newsfeed together is an incredibly complex piece of computation that requires all of these different machines to be running perfectly. And that's the only way you can do that kind of stuff at scale. And so just going and turning off microservices is just, it's just a statement that doesn't make any sense. Because if you just go stop shutting off these services, Twitter's just gonna stop working, which is effectively almost what they've been doing because they keep on firing people. What I was hearing was, you know, every big company has an on-call schedule. Well, you'll have a list of, for each back-end service, here is the engineer who's on call, that when they started laying people off, they were laying people off and locking their accounts who are currently on call for back-end services. So that there's no way to actually get to the person whose job it was to fix something if it broke. So if they keep on acting in this way, where they just keep on randomly firing people on the back-end and randomly turning off services, Twitter's going to stop working at some point. It's just a totally crazy way to take over this thing that is this incredibly complex system that's been built over years and just assume that he knows how to re-architect it overnight when he has no experience at all with any kind of web scale services.
Right. And if that's on the back end, what you see on the front end, Casey Newton was reporting this week that part of those layoffs have been thousands of the contractors that Twitter hires to do the content moderation. So even if Musk hasn't shown great propensity for actually changing the rules like he said he was going to, and the rules are pretty much all still in place, firing the people that actually implement those rules is as good as getting rid of them in many ways.
And, so. And anecdotally, I have seen an uptick in spam and such. The other thing we've seen is all of the impersonation, right? That like the thesis of people will not spend $8 to either make a joke or to manipulate the stock price of a publicly traded company, that turns out to be an incorrect thesis, right? And we're seeing that over and over again, where people are totally willing to pay the $8, even if they're only up for a couple hours. And the best example of this was Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, lost billions of dollars in market cap thanks to an impersonation on Twitter, which is amazing.
So I've seen some tweets or analysis of this that says that was generally in line with a stock market drop across the industry at that point. So what do you think?
I've heard that, and I've also seen that a bunch of other stocks have recovered and they did not. So yes, it is very hard to always predict what's going on, but the coincidence is definitely up there, and a bunch of companies now after that have decided to stop advertising on Twitter because it's not a safe place. You've got PepsiCo saying Coke is better. You've got Coke saying if we get enough retweets, we're putting cocaine back into our Coke bottles, right? And so these are things that there's no way for people to tell whether they're legitimate accounts or not. It has become this crazy free-for-all. And it's funny to watch, but if you consider that up until this moment, Twitter made $5 billion a year from advertising, that's got to be half, maybe a quarter of what it used to be. I think we're going to see a cash crunch because my understanding is there's less than $1 billion on hand at the time that the handover happened. Twitter spends about $5 billion a year. One of the reasons he's cutting all these people and these contractors is he just doesn't have the cash to pay them anymore if their cash flow goes to effectively zero.
Right. So we have the lettuce, we have Twitter's technical systems, and we have Twitter's like commercial viability. Which one's going to go down first, I guess, is the question. There's also all these interesting issues, you know, very briefly with the verification badge and all of these impersonations. Once Twitter is adding a verification badge to something, you know, that quite likely becomes its own speech rather than the speech of the user in question. And so Section 230 only provides platforms immunity from what users say on their services. You know, if Twitter goes out and defames a bunch of people, it can't plead Section 230 immunity. And so, you know, there's all these really interesting legal issues about could these people sue Twitter for verifying and helping fraud, defamation, all these other claims as a result of them independently saying this account or making people think this account is real. Now, it's unclear at this stage what a blue check actually means on Twitter, whether people actually think that it means this is a real account at this point. But, you know, would I expect to see, you know, again, full employment program for lawyers. This is the Section 230 subject unit in the Elon Musk JD program that we're standing up.
Well, and I think there is an interesting question here. Like, generally, these Section 230 test cases aren't class action security cases. So now you have this huge bar. There's a huge number of lawyers who just do, every time a stock drops, end up suing everybody involved. And so the fact that those people are now getting involved in Section 230 issues, I think is going to be fascinating.
Okay, but Elon doesn't have time to worry about this because he's acquainting himself with Brazilian politics in some tweets you yes. pointed out to me this morning. What's going on?
Okay, so there was an election in Brazil. Before the election, the Brazilian Supreme Court kind of granted themselves the power to censor social media in Brazil. And my understanding is, for the most part, American companies are fulfilling those requests. They're at least geo-blocking in Brazil, even if they're not taking content completely down. Lula won, the socialist candidate. Bolsonaro lost. From my perspective, I'm not super happy. Like, I would, if I had to be like a fascist and a socialist to vote for, that kind of sucks from a choice. But like, you know, that's how it seems to have worked. And a bunch of right-wing supporters of Bolsonaro are saying that the election was rigged partially because the Brazilian Supreme Court was able to take down this content. And so today you have a prominent conservative journalist tweeting at Elon that he should be looking at censorship and election rigging in Brazil, and Elon taking it seriously and having interactions with this Bolsonaro supporter. Now, from my perspective, what to do about the Brazilian Supreme Court ordering you to take tweets down is not an easy issue. But if you're going to have a discussion at Twitter about how do we handle this complicated issue and how do we handle the Brazilian election, it's probably not because your CEO is like chilling with a super right-wing journalist on Twitter, right? And like doing it live via replies.
Right. It's on my list to review, he says. How urgent is this? I've got to review the microservices first.
Right. First, he has to turn off all the backend services and see what happens. Yeah, we'll just throw this big switch.
Before I weigh into these really complicated normative issues around international human rights law and respecting local law and, you know, which body we should defer to right. in the judgment of whether, you know, speech is illegal or not.
Well, at least he can go talk to his head of integrity. Oh, no.
Yeah, that's
well,
right.
Well, at least he can talk to his general counsel. Oh, yeah, shit. Or
exactly.
chief compliance officer. No.
His advisory board, his trust and safety advisory
oh,
board.
No.
Yeah, his ethics. Oh, man.
Chief compliance officer. Chief privacy officer has done. Oh, wow.
Right. Okay. But at least he has how many million? 115 million Twitter followers that he can bounce ideas
right.
off. So
right. He can call his little kitchen cabinet of venture capitalists who have never had a real job, who have spent their entire lives like writing spreadsheets, and go ask them, what should I do in Brazil?
That, right.
I would literally pay Elon, if you want some revenue, I will pay for Twitter Blue if you allow me to silently listen into the phone calls you have with Mike Solana and such, asking them what you should do in Brazil. That would be awesome.
He may be that desperate by the time we record next week. I have to say, I was enjoying the impersonation tweets, though. It felt like what Twitter does best, so I'm glad that Twitter is going down doing what it loved. My personal favorite was a Roblox impersonation account that tweeted, "We're adding sex to the game now," which is fantastic. There's always a content moderation angle to these things. You can't hold hands on Roblox, but you can get it on. So, yeah, that's great. Anything else to add before we sign out?
Right now, Twitter is still up. So, and hopefully it'll be up on Saturday. Do you know what is Saturday? You now work for a school that actually cares a little bit about football.
Oh, yeah?
Do you know what is coming up on this Saturday?
I do not know.
It is the big game.
The big game.
The
right.
big game.
Yeah.
The University of California versus Leland Stanford Junior University at football. Two teams that are horrible at the actual playing of football, which is always the best big game when both teams are really bad, because it becomes a really hard-fought, fun battle.
Well, my emotional investment in football may be like the right-wing media ecosystem with Carrie Lake's vote count, where like when we're up, I'm like, yes, I love football. I'm getting into this. When we're down, it's like, never cared.
Did you ever go to a Harvard-Yale game?
I did not. Was I missing some spectacular skilled football?
No, you did not. But I do recommend at the University of California Memorial Stadium, it'll be a beautiful day to go watch Cal hopefully beat Stanford and to retain the axe, the Stanford axe, which is the traditional prize of that victory.
Well, we will have to have an important update on this critical matter next Monday. That has been your moderated content news roundup for this week. The show is available in all the usual places, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Show notes are available at law.stanford.edu/moderated-content. This episode wouldn't have been possible without the research and editorial assistance of John Farino, policy analyst at the Stanford Internet Observatory. It is produced by Brian Pelletier. Special thanks to Alyssa Ashdown, Justin Fu, and Rob Huffman. See you next week for more moderated content.
Go Bears!